This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The Trial of Karen Reid, Part 2, it will be starting very soon, supposedly. We'll see. There could be factors that change the trajectory of this. Jury selection is underway, but we've seen other trials where jury selection is underway and something else becomes a hiccup and delays things, and they're certainly throwing some motions out there to possibly do that, asking for a stay as it's being looked at by it's not being looked at by the Supreme Court, but they're asking the Supreme Court to look at it. Joining me to discuss, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, and who's also going to be following this trial live as well with his wife, Allie, and it's going to be great to watch. So check out Defense Diaries for the live stream of all of that, and we'll give you recaps over here. So right now, as it sits, we're getting closer to a supposed start in this, but there's a lot of motions out there, including to the Supreme Court. Catch us up. Where is this going, and what sort of weight are behind some of these motions?
So yeah, they did file what they call a petition for a writ of certiorari, which is where you're asking the United States Supreme Court to take a peek and mm-hmm. what the appellate court did down there. And, you know, it's tough. It's tough to get the Supreme Court to say, all right, we're going to take it up and we're going to look at it. And so after they filed that, they then filed an application for a stay, which means that they're asking that they delay everything that's going on at the trial court level. And, you know, if that were granted, that would put a screeching halt to it. Mm-hmm. Like, Judge Cannoni would have nothing to say about it. Mm-hmm. That would just halt it in its tracks. The question would then become, you know, are they going to keep that jury that they've selected, the 10 or the 12 that they've got so far, or are they just going to release them, depending on how long it's going to take for the Supreme Court to reach a conclusion on this thing? I tend to think, and the interesting thing is with SCOTUS, with the Supreme Court of the United States, is that they are not feeling the same pressure that, say, for instance, when it was brought on the, you know, the federal level in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they brought the appeals up in the First Circuit, which is still a Massachusetts federal court. Massachusetts federal courts are going to be aware of what's going on in this thing, and they may have expedited it. I don't know that the Supreme Court of the United States is going to feel they got some major things cooking over there, right? Yeah, they've got a lot of stuff on their plate. And a lot of it is probably in their minds of greater importance than what's going on with this case. So they're just not going to have the same need for speed that mm-hmm. they might otherwise have if you're dealing with a Massachusetts court, mm-hmm. Like especially a state court, but even on the federal side, because they got a pretty quick decision from the appellate court over there. So you could tell that there was a sense of brevity from that side. The question then becomes, does this thing have any legs? And look, I mean, double jeopardy is an absolutely critical fundamental right.
Yeah.
You know, and it is, I think that there is a gaping hole in some cases. Now, this is a rare circumstance where, you know, you've had a lot of the jurors come out. You've had other jurors that have said that all 12 of them agreed and that they found her not guilty on counts 1 and 3. However, there was no verdict. You know, it's one thing that they said it in the back rooms. It's another thing that they didn't say it when they were out in that courtroom and it didn't get recorded as a verdict. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Supreme Court is going to recognize that it's an important issue, but that is a very slippery slope.
You cannot
create a situation where now all of a sudden you've created some kind of law wherein things that happen in the deliberation room are going to be considered as to what actually happened. Well, you know, it's like
it upends everything. I mean,
it's a super slippery slope, man.
Yeah.
Do
I believe this could have happened that way? Sure. But is there documentation that it happened that way other than he said, she said? I mean, do we have the jurors that filled out the form and checked all those boxes that we can look back as an affidavit and go, oh, they did all check those boxes? Or is it just, like I said, he said, she said that we think we did this, and, you know, some are saying it and some are saying nothing?
I think that the only argument that the problem with it is that I think it's probably been waived is when Jackson made the argument about the verdict form. Mm-hmm. And if you recall, him and Judge Cannone had a pretty lengthy argument about her changing that form, because on counts 1 and 3, there was not a box that said not guilty.
I remember that. It was a big issue.
It was a big issue. And, you know, the question then becomes, he raised it, but by way of them saying, look, we want you to give the Tui Rodriguez charge, did they then waive it? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like, because she did make some wording change. She didn't add the box, but she made some wording changes to the verdict form. And the question then becomes, had they not asked for the Tui Rodriguez charge, would that still be an issue that could be presented to the Supreme Court? Because if it's waived, you can't bring it up.
Yeah.
Like it's not going to be an argument that could be made there. And I have a sneaking suspicion that it's going to be considered to have been waived. And I think that that's going to be ultimately the biggest problem. You know, I mean, because look, if it was a situation where they just didn't understand the forms and they had all reached a conclusion as to 1 and 3, and, you know, and 1 being the big one, the murder charge, you know, you hate to think that she'd be forced to stand trial on it again. Sure. However, because it is double jeopardy.
Yeah.
But it's not, because they didn't render a verdict.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's.
I get it. I get in theory how this could have happened. At the end of the day, it's a communications issue, and not communicating how they should have done this. And if you're sitting there in the jury and you don't really know exactly how this works, and you don't have a bubble to fill in of guilty, not guilty, and you're like, well, I think I'm doing it correctly, and you're ready just to get the hell out of there at some point. I'm just why this wasn't raised to begin with in the courtroom? That's my other question. Could Judge Cannone have pulled the jury on each one of these things, or is that something that they don't do there in Massachusetts?
She absolutely could have.
There was an opportunity where it could have been done, because I wasn't clear if that was something that was not. There was another facet that was like, well, in theory, in other states, yes, but not there. So no, this could have been done, and it just. It's like everybody was just ready to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Judge Cannone was enamored with those notes from the juror. I thought that she thought that they were very clear.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you look at the language of the notes,
yeah,
I mean, it seems abundantly clear that they had not reached a conclusion as to any of the charges.
True.
I mean, it said it flat out in there.
They did not say, there was nothing, hey, we're set on these two, but this one we're stuck on. It was... We don't know what to do here.
Right. It would have been helpful had the juror that was writing the note said, hey, the one thing that we're not exactly certain on is this an all or nothing proposition. Is this a situation where we have to, like, we have to find her guilty on all the things, or we have to, like, find her not guilty on all the things, or, you know, or can we piecemeal them out? And they never asked that question.
Yeah.
And, you know, from the defense's perspective, you know, Allie and I were having this chat the other night with the lawyer, you know, over and you know, he posed it to us. And it's like, you know, if you guys had been sitting in that room, what would you have done? You know, what would you have asked for the Tui Rodriguez charge, meaning kind of the dynamite charge, you know, the instruction, like you got to go back one last time and try to work this thing out. And, you know, and the honest answer is like, I have no idea. It's easy to sit here and you know, armchair quarterback after the fact saying, oh yeah, of course. You know, when you're looking at it as a defense attorney and you have the ability to be able to walk out to those people, including the press after, you know, they come back with a mistrial and you're saying, well, the state couldn't prove their case. You know, that's the bottom line here. The state could not meet their burden, because even though it's certainly not technically a win, it is a win of sorts for the defense when she walks out not convicted. You know what I'm saying? So sure. they're probably of the mindset, yeah, let's get the hell out of here. Let's get the 2E charge and let's get the hell out of here. And we'll see if they're going to come at her again. You know, I mean, they had to know that they were going to come at her again in terms of retrying the case, but it's one of those situations that unless you're in that moment, it's super easy to be critical and say, oh, this is what I would have done, when you don't know, unless you're in that moment, what you would have done with respect to that. Now, the bigger question is the rule, the criminal rule in Massachusetts allows, to your earlier question, allows either the judge on her own motion to inquire with the jury whether or not they had reached no verdict on all of the counts, mm-hmm. or the attorneys could have asked her to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the rule allows for both of those things to happen. That's kind of the bigger issue. And when you have the fact that Alan Jackson had put forth such a strenuous objection and argument to that verdict form, you know, it's a little bit surprising that he wouldn't have said, look, in light of the fact that you didn't put that box in there, like, let's just ask. But it's also that situation where you may not want to get an answer that you don't want to hear.
True. You're rolling the dice.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's a really tough spot to be in. And I'm certainly not pointing fingers, because in that particular situation, knowing what you do as the attorney, you can't know, like I said, until mm-hmm. you're in that situation yourself. And because you're trying to do what's best for your client. You know, I mean, and you're having to guess to a certain extent, and, you know, they were out for days.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like the concept of like, all right, well, they may have found her guilty on one of the other counts and they just don't understand that they could have piecemealed it out. Like, I mean, you don't mm-hmm. know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
You know, and when you don't have that box where it says not guilty on 1 and 3, but we can't reach a conclusion as to 2. Because, I mean, to them, the word unanimous may be all-encompassing, meaning it has to be unanimous on all of them.
Yeah.
That they could, you know what I'm saying?
Which it's I all think, communication is what it all comes down to.
Really does.
Yeah.
Really
does. At the end of the day, if you're looking at this at the other end and you have nothing invested in this, you'd be like, this is a communications issue. This is, you know, it's as simple as that. And that's where it's like, okay, let's be royally clear. Maybe everybody, you know, involved in this takes a lesson from this and goes, okay, saw this happen once, don't want that to happen again, just in case. If they were to hold the jury, I mean, what's the right move here, in your opinion, with the fact that they did kind of throw it to see if the Supreme Court's going to bite and take a look at it, which they may or may not. At this point, with this kind of being up in the air, do you move forward with trial and continue with the jury selection? Or would it be wise for Cannone to say, we're going to put a stay on it, and you got to determine what to do with the jury and how long they could be out? There's a lot of you know, doors and Pandora's boxes that open with either move.
Yeah, I think she's going to proceed. I think she's going to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, I think the reality of the Supreme Court granting cert is it's a very, very slim, slim chance.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even want to put a percentage on it, but it's very, very unlikely
sure,
that they're
sure.
going to grant it. And if they're, and you know, in terms of that application for the stay, they're going to take a look at the brief. They're going to take a look at it, you know, the petition for the, you know, for certiorari. And they're going to kind of look at it and like, all right, we haven't fully vetted this thing yet, but based on what we're reading, we're not inclined to think that we're going to overturn this. And, you know, that being the case, they're probably not going to grant the stay. So, again, whether or not the Supreme Court of the United States is feeling the time pressure
mm-hmm.
and the fact that they're aware that they're currently picking a jury in this thing, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I would tend well, and to think
do they
not.
Care? Like, this, right. this is not comparable to most things in the United States Supreme Court. But I don't know.
I mean, I don't know either, but I think she's going to keep plugging yep. away. I think she's going to get the jury picked. And from what we hear, sounds like opening statements, if everything goes as planned, they're going to start next Tuesday is yep. the way it sounds. So
Let's talk about the accusations of collusion that we've been seeing brewing here as we're leading up to the trial with the blogger and Karen and the defense attorneys. There's a lot there. There's a lot that doesn't look very good. Obviously, it's going to depend who knew what when and who was saying what to who. Where do you think this all goes? Because there's a lot to unpack there. Let's start with Karen. And I mean, she flat out said she's been talking to him every day for hours on end and understands that, you know, going up to people's homes and knocking on their door is technically basically intimidating a witness. But they shouldn't be witnesses, according to her. This doesn't look good. The optics are not good. What do you glean from it as a defense attorney?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest takeaway is that they should have never have allowed her to get on that Max documentary.
Oh, sure. Yes.
I mean, that's the bell. Yeah, that's Exhibit A that you just don't let your client, not just in this case, but every case,
ever.
You just don't let your client go off, you know, on these interviews without. If you're going to do it, you have to be there and they have to be under a watchful eye and you have to be saying, nah, I wouldn't get into that, you know, if you're going to allow them to do it. So, I mean, that's the big thing. I mean, look, it sounds like they impaneled a grand jury and they tried to get her on that. I don't think that there's going to be anything that comes from that. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and there is no prohibition from her talking to whoever she wants. You know, I mean, she's a citizen. She's allowed to talk to whoever she wants to.
Sure.
Now, if it becomes a thing where, you know, somehow they're able to get it in at trial, you know, that's something else, right? That becomes problematic, you know. And I think as far as Aiden's concerned, people doing things at his behest is not necessarily him doing anything. And I think that if they want to sue him, they can do that. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? Like that, like, I don't know. Like, and ultimately we'll have to wait and see what goes down in his case
yeah.
with those charges as to whether or not, cause he like love him or hate him. The mm-hmm. dude is a journalist. You know, I mean,
I would argue that title. I would say, I think what he's doing is not journalism. It takes away from anybody who is a real journalist.
Well,
he's something. I
mean, you say that, but then the fact of the matter is, if you kind of look at how this story made it out to the public at large, it was really him.
No, I don't disagree with that. But I mean, his tactics are not that of a journalist.
Yeah, I mean, like, unless like what? Well, let me give you a little pushback. What about like Hunter S. Thompson? Like, I mean, he was certainly considered a gonzo journalist. He mm-hmm. he was a very in your face, said a lot of controversial shit. And
I don't know that I'm not super familiar on Hunter S. Thompson, so I can't, I have nothing to say because I don't know much about it. So.
Well, he's deceased. Rest okay. in peace. I was a big Hunter S. Thompson
okay.
fan. He wrote like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Okay. Okay.
But you know, and he was a guy who was very outspoken about a lot of different things.
Yeah, and there's investigative journalism, and then there's like terroristic journalism. And I feel like this guy is closer to that than it is, you know, actual, you know, investigative. I'm, you know, pushing the envelope a little bit. You know, when you're out there screaming at people in the road that you're a cop killer to people that, you know, don't really have a whole lot in the game here. And then harassing their kids and all like that. That's not journalism. When you're going over that line, that's just, it's not, is it? It's
no, I yeah. like involving anybody's yeah. children. Like,
yeah. And that's what gets me. Like you want to harass the main people in this or dig it like, cool, whatever. It's part of the story. It shouldn't be okay that they're part of this because I think the whole thing is insane. But it's, I get that. But when you're going to like family intimidation, that's like mob stuff. Like, what are you doing? It just doesn't feel right. It's not right. It's not fair. It's not okay. And it's not journalism. It's something. But I mean, it's something. It's sure. I mean, it's getting content. It's creating content of certainly for him. But I wouldn't call it a journalist.
Yeah, I mean, like ultimately, I think he'll have his day in court.
Yeah.
Whether or not you know, they're weaponizing criminal statutes to silence people because they don't like his approach.
Sure.
I guess is something that 12 people in that jury box are going to decide, you know. Sure. It's like I obviously can, you know, look at it from an objective perspective and be like, yeah, that's, you know, that's an approach.
it's something,
it's a good one. Yeah.
It's something, you know. but then you get to the area where obviously the argument of collusion gets made of, you know, did he go and harass some of these people to such an extreme length based on encouragement from the Karen Reed camp, whether it was directly from Karen Reed or whether it was directly from his attorneys. That's where I think it gets to be some interesting territory. I mean, you're the one that's the attorney. I mean, did they, you know, from your view, step into an area here where this is collusion? That granted, we don't know everything, but what we've seen thus far with some of these texts, it's like, okay, this is a little weird.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I would just have to see all of it in order to kind of know where that thing is going to lay. You know, and again, they impaneled a grand jury as to her. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm assuming that they saw all the same things, right? And the grand jury, you know, came back with a no true bill of indictment against Karen. Mm-hmm. So, like, they clearly didn't think, and that's a grand jury of citizens.
Sure.
You know, that, and you know that the Commonwealth was motivated to have them charge her with that. So mm-hmm. they brought their best foot forward.
Yeah.
I'm assuming at that point, and they didn't have enough to get the 12 citizens. Cause typically the saying about a grand jury is you can indict a ham sandwich. Mm-hmm. Cause it's typically a rubber stamp. So, with respect to that, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and as far as
maybe like they wanted egg salad that day.
Yeah. Like, I mean, to me, like, I'm interested from the concept of, you know, the First Amendment.
Yeah.
You know, where is that line drawn?
Sure.
You know, like when is too much too much? You know, like what is the role of an investigative journalist? Mm-hmm. I mean, you see, you know, like over the course of my life, I've seen some very in your face journalists,
sure,
you know, that are asking really tough questions. And I mean, certainly, like, he's abrasive,
yeah,
you know, at the same point, I think if I'm Carney, like my argument is like, well, I actually think that they did do it,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, yeah. I mean that, like, and maybe I'm wrong on it or maybe I'm right. And, you know, it's like, so, you know, like I get how he rubs people the wrong way.
Sure.
You know, but again, you know, they've charged him with 16 counts. I think they added another one or two mm-hmm. recently. You know, and some of the behavior is obviously not okay. Like
sure.
clearly,
yeah.
You know, I mean, that is without question. I think all of us can agree that, you know, some of it's not okay. But in terms of if you have journalists out there that are trying to expose corruption, it's not an easy thing to do.
No, and I agree. Like, we try to expose it here, you know, when we're talking about some of these cases, you know, like Delphi and things of that nature.
I think a lot of the same shit that Aiden does.
Yeah, but it's a tactic, it's the approach, it's all of that I think changes it from journalism to, again, I don't know what to even call it, but
yeah,
it's something.
It's an interesting case, and I'm talking about his case.
Sure.
And we've been covering him because I think that the First Amendment implications are important in terms of that. And, you know, in terms of kind of that statute in Massachusetts with the intimidation statute, you know, when you're challenging the constitutionality of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, it becomes an interesting case, and it's going to be a case that I think is going to really kind of leave a mark in terms of moving forward for journalists in terms of, are they going to make a demarcated line
mm-hmm.
in terms of, you know, because
yeah,
I mean, the First Amendment is kind of everything in this country. It was like, mm-hmm. It's the First Amendment for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's of the utmost importance that we can be able to challenge our government. And, you know, I mean, a lot of the people involved on that side of it are the government.
You know,
I mean, that's fact. So, I mean, look, there's going to be 12 people that are going to hear those cases.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're going to come to the conclusions, and they're going to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly of all. So it's all going to come out, you know, and ultimately they're going to have to come to a decision as to whether or not he's guilty on those charges. Sure. Like I, to me, the remedy for the witnesses in that case is civil court.
Sure.
You know, that like it's not as if they don't have a remedy. I mean, you come in and there's slander and there's libel and there's ways that you can challenge and try to get compensated for the harm, you know? And I mean, typically the way that we do that in this country is through the civil courts. And now what they've done is they've kind of weaponized the criminal statute to shut a guy up because they hate the way that he does his business. So
why haven't we seen any civil cases brought at this point? I mean, there's certainly been that as part of this with libel and slander and some of the horrible things that have been accused here. I mean, is that something that would likely more come after the criminal trial why would they wait to file any sort of civil suit?
Well, I mean, the bigger question is that there's, you know, a statute of limitations. Like, so you have to preserve the statute on that in terms of like how long they can wait before they bring suit.
Sure.
You know, I think the other interesting part of it is always the fact that, you know, if you sue somebody for libel or slander, you know, the defense is truth, you know? So, if there is any part of what he's saying that's true, and that civil discovery, and we've talked about it in other cases, and you know, they get to start doing depositions and they have interrogatories, and you really start to get digging into these people's, you know, far deeper than they've been able to prior to.
Yeah.
Maybe that gives them pause. I don't know. I don't know why they haven't filed, to be honest.
That's interesting. One more point on this. It goes back to Karen Reed's pickle chip comments, where she's standing in front of the court like, oh God. And then Karen, come on, let's go over here. Let's stop talking to the journalist. Her defense fund. I know a lot of people feel kind of ick about this because, you know, she's saying that they're not getting paid. Nobody's getting paid. It's all pro bono. Enlighten me on this. If I'm taking this one way where it's like, well, where is the money going? Maybe you can help answer that and make some sense of this.
Yeah. Well, I think that you've got costs for a trial like this when you have the number of experts that they have coming in. The experts are certainly getting paid.
Okay.
You know, there's no way that experts aren't getting paid now. I mean, she's got a pretty big chunk of cash in there. You know, but in terms of experts for their trial time that they have to come in, they have to travel, they have to be put up, they have to be fed. Like you pay for all those things. They do have a rather lengthy, list of expert witnesses. Additionally, I don't know what the situation is. I know that the trial lawyers are doing this pro bono. I don't know that, say, the appellate lawyers are doing it pro bono. I tend to think that they probably are not, but I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, ultimately at the end of the day, you know, is there going to have to be an accounting? I don't know.
Like, is it fraud? I guess is my question. If you're not paying these people, and I get, like, that's why I'm saying, what other expenses are going on here that I just don't know? Because I just don't know. And that's, you know, I totally get expert witnesses and all that. And I guess they're like feeding the supporters outside. Again, it's not necessarily defense. I mean, well, the expert witnesses are, but if you're feeding the free Karen Reed people, that's not really supporting your defense. And if you're asking money for the Karen Reed defense fund and you're not using that for your defense, is that fraud? And I guess what are you saying is the defense your pantsuits? And I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what would be allowed and what wouldn't be allowed or considered part of that defense fund. Is it just solely paying your attorneys, or is it the ecosystem that, you know, has been created around all of this that needs to be funded? And then does that count for that? I don't know.
Well, I think it depends on what they've declared initially through the crowdfunding, like in terms of what it was for.
Yeah.
Like for instance, in Richard Allen's case, they had created a fundraiser because at the point in time when they created it, Judge Gull had not given the defense money to hire experts.
Sure. Yeah.
So that particular fundraiser was created specifically with the the thought in mind that they were going to pay the experts, which they did use portions of it to pay the experts for. It's going to be the same thing. Like whether or not they were paid, because I know they didn't do the first trial, and I'm talking about Karen Reed's trial attorneys didn't do the first trial pro bono. I know that they're doing the second one pro bono, but
maybe it's going to that.
Yeah. I mean, maybe some of it went to that. Maybe, you know, it's going to make her whole. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know as far as the expert witnesses go, that they'll definitely be using those funds to pay experts, and experts are expensive.
Oh, they are. Yeah.
You know, I mean, like the ARCA guys, like we saw what their bill was just for the small amount that they did, cause they had already done their report. You know, at the time, and I think what did they end up paying those guys? 29 or
something
27?
Like that. It was in the '20s. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was like after the DOJ had already paid them for the actual work.
Yeah.
So I mean, that just kind of gives you an idea of how expensive these cases are in terms of trying them, when you're trying them at the level that they're trying this case, in terms of being able to bring in experts about everything.
Sure.
You know, in fighting on everything, because you have a lot of experts.
Yeah.
You know, you got a lot of things that are at issue.
That's why I wanted to ask that, because I wanted to be like, well, stop paying. Like, there's more. Let's get some more context. Let's try and understand this better of what this all means. And I mean, does that need to be accounted for at the end of the day? Or is it like, well, if you decided to donate to her and you gave her the money, that's at the end of the day up to her how she wants to use it? Or is there anything that...
I don't know. Like, yeah. I honestly don't know how that that crowd fundraising works in terms of like... what happens at the end game of it.
Yeah, you know? I don't know. Like, I
honestly don't know. I've never done it. So it's like, I don't know. Like I know that if you don't hit a goal, like if you set a goal and you don't hit that goal, that all the money is returned. I don't know what happens if you meet the goal. I don't know if there's anybody that's like saying, all right, well, we need an accounting of what you're doing. Like, I don't know that answer.
I don't know. Yeah, there's just a lot I don't know there. But that's why I wanted to bring that up, because it's kind of a new world where we have this sort of thing, this easily and readily available to anyone who wants to do it, and then have anybody around the world be able to contribute to something that they otherwise wouldn't know about. So, I don't know, just an interesting point as she says things that seem to kind of contradict what was the goal. I don't know. That's why we ask the questions. Many more still to come in this case. Obviously, the jury, as of this recording, has not yet been seated, and probably next week we'll have a lot more to talk about in the trial of Karen Reed.
The latest true crime stories, expert breakdowns, and shocking twists, all in one place. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.